Former Los Angeles Times film critic Kenneth Turan will be at the Yiddish Book Center in Amherst, Massachusetts, to discuss his new book, Louis B. Mayer and Irving Thalberg, The Whole Equation. The event is Sunday, May 11th at 2 p.m. Sharing a religion and an evangelical zeal for film, Louis B. Mayer and Irving Thalberg were unlikely partners in one of the most significant collaborations in movie history. Over the course of their decade-long friendship as key players at MGM and major players in Hollywood, they joined forces in redefining and mastering the template for the film industry. Again, the name of the book is Louis B. Mayer and Irving Thalberg, The Whole Equation, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Kenneth Turan to the roundtable this morning. Kenneth, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, it's great to be here.
So give me a sense, wonderful to have you, and I thank you very much for the time. Give us a sense of at what point you wanted to write about these two men.
That's a good question. They always have fascinated me kind of in the back of my mind. I mean, Irving Thalberg is, you know, if you watch the Oscars, they give out the Irving Thalberg Award. They don't tell you anything about who he is. And, you know, the book by Scott Fitzgerald, The Last Tycoon, the lead character is based on Thalberg. He's always been kind of a mythic character lurking in the background in Hollywood. And Mayer has been a mythic character as well. He's been on screen portrayed by a whole variety of actors. They both have, in very different ways, larger than life personalities. And that really attracted me. I wanted to know how they got together. I wanted to know how they worked together. I wanted to know everything I could find out about them. And when I decided to leave the Times, I was looking for a book that I would to do. And this, I said, well, this is what you've always been interested in. Why don't you do this? So that's what happened.
One of the things that surprised me is of how much was accomplished in a relatively short period of time, of a decade-long relationship, and how much came out of that.
Yeah, that's a good point. There was no internal resistance. They were kind of creating the movie business from the ground up, almost by the seat of their pants. So there was no establishment for them to fight against. Whatever they felt like doing, they just went out and did, as long as, you know, they could find the money for it and they could find the people for it. So I think that accounts for how rapidly it all happened. They were really creating the movie business, you know, one step at a time.
So give us a sense, you touched on this a moment ago, of how they met, of how they came to team up together.
Well, Hollywood in those days, and we're talking the early 1920s, when they teamed up, you know, it was a very small community. People kind of knew of each other if they didn't actually know each other. Louis B. Mayer at the time was running his own company, Louis B. Mayer Productions, and he felt like he needed help. If he wanted to turn out more films, he needed someone else to help him put the films together. And he seemed to realize that he needed someone whose sensibility was both aligned with his and yet had a different take on things. And someone suggested that he talk to Irving Thalberg, who at the time was running Universal, even though he got the job. You know, the line is he got the job when he was too young to sign the checks. He was running the studio. He was under 21 when he first got the job of running Universal. But he was chafing at Universal. He felt he wanted to have more power. This Universal was owned by Carl Laemmle. Carl Laemmle had like hordes of relatives who Thalberg couldn't control, who had certain amount of power. He just wanted to have a closer attempt at running his own shop. And so they were both looking for each other. A lawyer brought them together. They had dinner at Mayer's house. And, you know, it was like a done deal after that dinner.
One of the things that you talk about was how MGM was known as the quality studio. What brought that to the fore, to the point of that it was noted that if people went into a movie theater and they saw the logo, they would applaud?
Yes, the Leo the Lion logo, which you can still see now. It says MGM Amazon because Amazon has bought MGM. But that lion still roars. You know, they both shared something. which we take for granted today, but was very much an open question when they were working, which was that film was an art. That film was not an offshoot of vaudeville. Film was not an offshoot of traveling circuses. Film was an art that could move people as well as make money. They wanted to make money, but they really felt that the film was something of value. And this was not generally accepted in the culture. You read newspaper stories back in the day, and people are just astonished when there's any good films come out because they had expectations for the movie industry was so low. And so they both share this, and that's what made all this happen.
The studio was founded in 1924. Mayer is the CEO. Thalberg is the head of productions. And from very early on, they became known as where for their star power, for bringing on these amazing stars, which certainly was part of the success, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, they really, one of their mottos was more stars than there are in the heavens. No one was counting, but that was the motto. They believed in stars, and they believed that stars, especially female stars, they believed that female stars in involving stories would draw women into the theaters, and that women would bring their husbands or their boyfriends. And that's one of the things that drove their belief in stars. And they had very rapidly some of the top star female stars in Hollywood. They had Greta Garbo, who was a huge star and made all her films for MGM. Joan Crawford was a big star at MGM Discovery, and Norma Shearer, who ended up marrying Thalberg, also had a huge following. So they very rapidly, wanted to and did develop female stars.
When you look at the output of what MGM did at that time, compare it a little bit to some of the other studios and what they were doing and how it stood out.
Well, each studio, in a way that really isn't true anymore, a lot of the studios had personalities for their films. I mean, I think the only studio today that has a personality is Disney. If you say it's a Disney film, people know what you're talking about. In
Right.
those days, Paramount, for interest, had a lot of Europe directors who had been born in Europe, and their films had kind of more European sophistication about them by and large. Warner Brothers, they were made grittier films. They made gangster films. They made socially conscious films. But MGM, their goal was quality. Their goal always was quality. They wanted to be known as the quality studio, and they made that happen. That's why people applauded, because they knew that MGM films would have a certain degree of polish, really great production design, costume design. There would be stars in the key roles. MGM did it right.
Kenneth Turan is our guest. The name of the new book is Louis B. Mayer and Irving Thalberg, The Whole Equation. And he'll be speaking at the Yiddish Book Center in Amherst, Massachusetts on Sunday afternoon. One of the things you write in the book is that they thought their movies could change things. What were they looking to change?
A good question. Well, one again, as I said before, one of the things they were looking to change were people's perceptions of movies. But they also, and sometimes their films did and didn't reflect this, they also felt that film could be a force for good. It could convince people to act, in a civilized manner. It could help people understand each other. They felt that films could do good in the world, just in the way we sometimes feel that novels do. Or stars do. But they really felt that film could do this. And as I say, this was an unusual thought at the time. Most people thought films were very disposable. The best you could hope of them was that they wouldn't do any harm. And Thalberg and Mayer really felt that they could get people to act better. They could model good behavior. And that is to say, they wanted to make a profit. They weren't, saints. They weren't. In fact, there's a early a book 50 years ago, there was a book written about both of them called The Make-Believe Saints. They were not saints, but they did feel that film could do good.
The book is part of Yale's Jewish Lives series, and I'm curious as to how much of the Jewish background was important in for them and for the work that they did, especially in those early days of Hollywood.
Well, their Jewish qualities were interesting because they were very different. Meyer was a classic Eastern European immigrant. No one knows, literally, people are not sure what city he was born in. They're not sure the date of his birth. Even though he claimed July 4th because he was a big believer in the United States, nothing is really, they don't know exactly what his name was when he was born. So he came to this country and he was an immigrant to Canada first. He didn't get to this country until, in his late teens, early 20s. On the other hand, Thalberg was born in this country, born in Brooklyn before everyone wanted to live there. His family were German Jews. And the German Jews had come to, they were not Yiddish speaking as the Eastern European Jews were. They had come to the United States decades before the Eastern European Jews. They were, by their own account, they were more sophisticated, more cultured. They became quite wealthy. And by the time Eastern European Jews started to arrive in this country, the German Jews were not that happy with them because they were, by and large, less sophisticated. There was a real feeling that they were kind of going to be, that their arrival would be bad for the Jews. So there was a certain innate kind of tension between the two of them. But also, I felt that there was for Meir to have a kind of, this is like the son he never had. Meir had two daughters, and throughout his career, he was always looking for the son he never had. And Thalberg was the son he never had, but a German Jewish son, which made, I can feel that that made a huge difference in their relationship, that Meir was just kind of tickled to be so close to someone who on some level was that different.
You used the word innate a moment ago. This is something of that the difference, but that something they certainly never commented on, but pretty sure that they felt and knew the difference was there.
Exactly. I doubt that they ever talked about it, but I also do not doubt that they were intensely aware of the difference. In that period, the people were very much aware of that difference, and they just dealt with it.
One of the things about Thalberg is known for this ability to produce commercial hits as well as critical hits. What did he do that in your mind that was different, that was special, and then something that Louis B. Mayer was able to understand and work with to put the films out into the world?
He, from his day to this, no one has been able to understand how Thalberg was able to do what he did. It's quite clear what he could do, and people just feel that it was innate in him. He just had a gift for plot and for construction and for story. He could sense when a film wasn't, and it's part of it. He did extensive audience testing. He did previews on a regular basis, and he would go to the previews and he would walk around the theater and different parts of the theater to get a sense of what different sections of the audience felt about a given film. He could just know how to fix films to make them successful. There, and, the book is filled with stories of this. And even though some people, everyone didn't love him, he could be cool, he could be distant, but no one ever said Thalberg doesn't know what he's doing. It was accepted by everyone because there was evidence that Thalberg had this innate gift for knowing what was wrong with a film, why it wasn't connecting to an audience, and being able to fix it. And partly he was able to fix it because in the studio system, MGM basically owned all the people who worked for them. And if reshoots were needed, he could call the actors back. No matter what they were doing, he could say, take a day, he could say, you're taking a day off from your schedule, you're going to the set, and we're going to rebuild the set, and you're going to, do this new scene. And the directors would come in and direct for a day. And if they were busy, some other director who hadn't done the original film would come in and direct it. So Thalberg had this great system in place where he could put into place the changes he thought were necessary, and the changes he thought were necessary were inevitably correct. And no one knows where this came from, but this was an innate quality he had that was indisputable.
You make the point in the book, and I think it's interesting just on what you were talking about, that writers are certainly known for the last thing they want is an executive walking in and having notes on what they're doing. And yet writers liked Thalberg and they liked the notes.
Yeah, I mean, he had an innate connection with writers. They really did like his stories, his notes. I mean, Francis Marion, who was one of the great screenwriters of the era, an Oscar winner. When she wrote a book on screenwriting, a how-to book on screenwriting, she dedicated it to Thalberg. But these people were people, and Thalberg, even though he loved writers and got on really well with writers, when the writers started to organize, when the Writers Guild came into being, he was dead set against it. He didn't understand why writers wanted to organize. He would tell people, "You guys are not plumbers. What are you doing organizing?" And this caused a real rift between him and some of the writers he was closest to. So, even though he loved writers, he had a blind spot where this was concerned, and he just felt that writers shouldn't be organizing, and they felt they had good reason to organize.
Thalberg basically saved the Marx Brothers' career.
That is correct.
They were at Paramount and it didn't go well. They didn't renew the contract. So what did Thalberg see and to say? Because in my reading of the book, even William B. Mayer didn't necessarily want to hire them.
Yeah, he didn't. I mean, there are a lot of it situations where, Thalberg would have an idea. Mayer would think it wasn't such a good idea, but he would let Thalberg go ahead with it, and usually Thalberg was correct. Thalberg felt that he could salvage their careers, and he did big things and he did small things. One of the big thing he did was he felt, the films they did in Paramount were completely anarchic, and there are people who believe that those films were the best Marx Brothers films. But the audience is tired of them. They didn't want that. That's why the contract wasn't renewed. And what Thalberg, the first big thing he did is he said, "I want to put a romantic subplot in your films. It'll attract a broader audience, and you can still do the same crazy stuff you do, but this will exist alongside of it." And that proved to be a very effective tactic. Their box office went up and up and up once Thalberg took over production of their films. And he also, on kind of even on a smaller level, he had them, one, I forget which film it was, but he came up with the idea, or they came up with the idea, and he approved it. They had started in vaudeville, and they were used to an audience. And once the script for one of their films was finished, he allowed them to tour it around kind of a circuit of vaudeville theaters in California, so that they could work out the timing, so that they could know when to pause for laughter, so that people wouldn't miss the punchline. That was very effective, and the Marx Brothers loved it. And Groucho, who was probably the longest lived of the Marx Brothers, to the end of his days, he would, despite critics loving the earlier films, Groucho was hugely a partisan of Thalberg. Really, was always giving interviews about how much Thalberg had saved them and how good he was at figuring out how their films should be structured. And so the Marx Brothers themselves were very happy with what Thalberg did for them.
At the very beginning of our conversation, Kenneth, I asked you about how much they accomplished in a relatively short period of time. The short period of time comes because Thalberg dies at just 37 years old, which is so young. Again, incredible to think of what was accomplished and what could have been accomplished had he survived.
Yeah, I mean, it was always known that, he from the day he was born with heart issues, and it was thought that he would not live, that he would not live a long and full life. So this was always something that was in the back of everyone's mind. But still, and actually, frankly, he ended up dying of pneumonia. He didn't die of heart disease, though it's possible the heart disease weakened him to the point where the pneumonia kind of kicked in. People were still shocked. I mean, even though everyone knew that his early death, it was not a secret in Hollywood that he had this heart condition and that he might die young, his early death shocked people. And there was an outpouring of public emotion when he died that I don't think has happened since for an executive. You have a lot of outpourings of emotion and people being sad when movie stars die or when directors die. But for an executive to get an outpouring like this, that had not happened before, and I don't believe it's happened since.
How did it affect Louis B. Mayer?
Well, Mayer and Thalberg, they were very close till they weren't. When they first met, Irene Mayer Selznick, who was Louis B. Mayer's daughter and later the wife of David O. Selznick, she said, "My father never loved anyone the way he loved Irving. They were exceptionally close. But one of the things that started to happen was that Thalberg, because he was so young and so capable, so young, he started to be called in the media the boy genius. The more they used this phrase, which Thalberg didn't particularly like but couldn't stop, the more Mayer felt slighted. Felt like his contribution to the studio, his ability, for instance, to discover actors and to convince actors to sign, that this was being slighted. So there was a jealousy factor that was involved. But Thalberg was really essential to the working of MGM. And once he died, there was a momentum he created that lasted for a number of years. But Mayer was always looking for someone to replace him and really never succeeded in finding anyone.
After working with a subject, two subjects for so long, do you get a sense of how they would think of 100% tariff on movies coming in from other countries?
Well, I think they think it was kind of nuts, but the overseas market was very important to them, and I just said they would just scratch their head. Well, there's so much that's going on today in the movie business that would allow them to scratch their head. I mean, the notion that people, this whole issue of people not wanting to shoot in Hollywood and shooting in other parts of the country, this was unheard of. I mean, no one
Right.
was shooting in Atlanta in those days. No one was shooting in New Mexico. I mean, the whole system that has evolved would baffle them.
Kenneth Turan was a film critic for the Los Angeles Times for nearly 30 years, also film critic for National Public Radio. He is the author of the new book, Louis B. Mayer and Irving Thalberg, The Whole Equation. Kenneth will be at the Yiddish Book Center in Amherst, Massachusetts on Sunday, that is May 11th, Sunday, May 11th at 2 p.m. in person or Zoom. And you can find out more information about the event by going to yiddishbookcenter.org, yiddishbookcenter.org. Kenneth Turan, I thank you very much for spending time with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Well, thank you, Joe. I really enjoyed it. It was really a treat to talk to you.
Be well. Again, the name of the book, Louis B. Mayer and Irving Thalberg, The Whole Equation. The book is published by Yale. Kenneth Turan will be at the Yiddish Book Center on Sunday, May 11th at 2 p.m. You can find out more at yiddishbookcenter.org. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.